Welcome to Alpha Trader. Coming up on the show, Greg King, CEO and founder of Osprey Funds, here talking about Bitcoin and its recent volatility, as well as the launch of the new Osprey Bitcoin Trust. But first, in recent months, Stephen and I, we've had a series of guests who've been bullish on stocks to varying degrees, none more so than our next guest, John Markman. He's president and founder of Markman Capital, an independent investment research publisher. He publishes the Daily Strategic Advantage newsletter, as well as the Tactical Options newsletter. You can find them all at markmancapital.net. He's also publishes the Fast Forward Investing newsletter on Forbes, which is the name of one of the several books he's written on investing. John, welcome back to Alpha Trader and happy birthday.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here on your birthday. And again, as I mentioned, you were here in late October and you said something that I almost fell over, and I believe Stephen did as well. You said, you know, based on what the Fed had done back last March, that you would expect the Dow would be up 5x over the next 5 years.
10 years.
And had a, 10 years, I'm sorry. Okay, 10 years with a price target of 91,000 for the Dow and 33, almost 34,000 for the NASDAQ. Has anything in the last 4+ months caused you to change that point of view, either to upgrade or downgrade it?
Did I say 91,000 for the Dow? I meant 92,000.
92,000. Okay. So slight raising of the price target there. So
there you go.
That's to say you're still very bullish here for the next several years. And then there's, you know, there's a lot of people saying like, okay, we're at some sort of blow off top here and things are getting too frothy. And you don't see it that way.
You have to understand that stocks are not driven by earnings so much as they are by the availability of credit and money. And as long as the Federal Reserve has made it its business to pump money into the system, it's very unlikely that you're going to get a major bear market or even much of a correction.
Interesting. Okay.
So I'm sticking to my guns. I think we'll be up. That will be up as much as 90,000 to 90,000 in 10 years. And the NASDAQ, as you said, up to around 34,300.
All right. That's certainly, you know, going to surprise a lot of people who, again, who are thinking that maybe this recent rise in rates is the beginning of the end of something. Are you concerned at all about inflation and the competition from rising yields would present for stocks?
Yeah, I mean, the stocks and bonds are always in competition, right? if you can get a risk-free rate of 2 or 3 or 4 or 5%, you know, why bother with the risk of stocks? But, you know, rising rates are coming off of a real low level, and now they're around 1.6%, something like that. I don't really see that as much of a competition. And frankly, the reason that this is even happening is that, you know, the Fed is flooding the market with money, and that's in its intention. Its absolute goal is to raise inflation. So do you want to stand in front of the Fed? Go ahead. And it's never been a good plan.
If there were, say, a rate hike cycle in which they began to take liquidity away, and a lot of people are placing bets, a lot of smart people are placing bets on that happening, maybe as soon as next year, would that change your opinion at all?
You know, rising rates and rising stocks are not incompatible. In fact, most of the rises of this rises of the stock market have been accompanied by rising rates. Rising rates just means that the economy is improving, and so it's really not that big of a problem. I would think that the bigger problem is that inflation. A lot of people don't know really what the connection between stock prices and inflation is. The real problem, I mean, if for an inflation is that it suppresses price earnings ratios. So price earnings multiples are the hidden lever behind the value of stocks. And inflation, the higher inflation goes, the more that they eats away at that at PEs. So that's more of what I'm worried about than just an absolute rise in prices.
Well, that's interesting because I was going to ask you if the rise in inflation or expectations, I should say inflation expectations, is causing you to rethink the types of stocks you want to own. We're talking here midday Monday, and the Dow is basically flat. NASDAQ's down 1.8%, and a lot of big cap tech stocks, Facebook, Apple, Tesla, among them, have had some pretty significant weakness, you know, 10 to 15%, depending on which name, in the last couple of weeks.
Well, you know,
are we seeing a rotation out of those high PE names, high growth names?
Well, strangely enough, NASDAQ has investors have been rotating out of the NASDAQ for about 6 months. I mean, if you go back to September 2nd, which was the high of the market before the election. The Nasdaq's only about up about 6% in that period, whereas energy is up about 35%. So there's been a big rotation already that's kind of hidden. And I think that rotation is going to continue. You know, and it's simply because, you know, it's just a bunch of reasons, but one of them is kind of ironic. You know, the new Biden administration is anti-energy for a variety of reasons. But you know, when you take away capacity, like with the Keystone Project and other actions that they've taken, what you end up doing is creating a more scarcity for oil and gas, and then that supports the stock prices of these oil and gas companies. And when I talk about energy stocks to my customers, you know, I really my business is to have a technology focus. And I've been super impressed with the technology of big oil services companies like Schlumberger, SLB. You know, SLB really is a technology company within the energy business, and they've taken the last few years to really revamp their business and improve the availability of energy through a variety of mechanical and software means.
So that's really interesting because you spoke with us last time about digital transformation. And are you trying to say that the digital transformation and hence massive opportunity. We're not just talking like a 30% bounce off the lows. We're talking about multi-baggers. Are you saying that's coming to some energy names now?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's companies like Baker Hughes and Schlumberger will at least double in the next couple of years. And because there's, for one thing, they're so hated. You know, there's a lot of people still need to be persuaded that this is a good place to be. But ultimately, people will realize that, you know, it's unavoidable.
Right. So I think you answered my question, but I was asking you about if, you know, rising rates and is going to cause you to shift your focus away from technology stocks as we think of them, you know, specifically. But I think you just said, you know, your business is focused on that sector, right? So that's still where you're focusing most of your attention here.
Yeah, but you know what? This rotation has forced us to look more broadly at what technology is and what the digital transformation is doing to various industries. And that's really led us to understand more about how technology, the digital transformation has affected, you know, companies like Schlumberger, but not just the energy makers, energy technology companies, but also I've been really fascinated to study the auto industry and how it's making a digital transformation to electric cars. Investors are still missing this big transition, and they're skeptical about the transition to electric cars. But Ford just announced that, you know, that they're going to spend $29 billion refitting its factories by 2025. Volkswagen has committed $100 billion to reformatting its factories, and of course General Motors made a big commitment to electric as well. So this is a really important development that investors are kind of are not really seeing properly, because when we say electric cars, they automatically just think of Tesla.
Right. That begs the question. Last time we spoke to you, you said you know you were a fan, but you weren't in the stock. Do you have any position or recommendations on Tesla here?
Just super impressed with what Elon Musk has been able to do. You know, we talked last time, I think, about Netflix and how they created a digital business from scratch when everyone said they couldn't. And this is really what Elon Musk has done, is he's created a digital business from scratch over the past 15 years. Has become extremely so successful that the rest of the auto industry is emulating him.
Right, but you think there's better opportunities for investors in some stocks in the electronic and autonomous vehicle space beyond Tesla. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, transportation is in the midst of the biggest change since 1908 when the Ford Model T was introduced. And this transition is going to bring electrification, always-on connectivity, and also self-driving. You know, when the Model T came out, most people moved around by horse. But the Model T spawned a new era of industrial innovation. And it's interesting that it's very similar to the innovation that we're seeing now. The one of the key elements of the Model T that was important was this single modular platform that supported multiple body styles and engines, as well as their moving, you know, assembly line that helped them bring down the price of a car constantly over the next few years. And this is the same thing that's happening in cars, where GM and Ford are moving to more modular platforms where they have a single battery and basically what they call a skateboard that they can fit a variety of body styles on top of. And as they do this, people are going to be, as this transpires, you're going to see that Ford and General Motors will ultimately be priced as if they were technology companies rather than old industrials.
Wow.
So I think you're going to see, I think you could see Ford double or triple from here over the next few years. And the same with General Motors. If they don't screw it up, which they're always, you know, is always a possibility.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent possibility, but considering their past. But so when you talk about Ford, GM, Volkswagen spending, you know, insane billions to kind of retrofit everything. So you're a bull on those names, but who's selling those picks and shovels? Who's going to benefit other than those companies from all those tens or hundreds of billions that they're going to spend?
Well, I mean, Ford and General Motors by themselves are really hated companies, and they've got low, very, very low multiples. So, you know, as in right now, you know, you guys are even sort of shrugging your shoulders saying that's impossible. So that's a good sign. but there are many other, you know, great stocks in this industry. You know, if you want to go way out there, there's a Chinese company called NIO, N-I-O, that's the fastest growing EV maker in China. It sold 7,300 vehicles in December, which is an increase of 350% from a year ago. The stock has, you know, has done well, but its shares traded at 32 times sales, which is high, but it just shows that investors are confident in their ability to move forward. Outside the United States, Volkswagen, I said, has done nothing. The stock has done nothing for the past 10 years. They've committed $100 billion to digitalization. And they see themselves as in a race with Tesla to be the biggest automaker in the world. So right now, it only trades at 9.2 times earnings, which is super low, and 0.5 times sales. So I think their stock is really, really cheap. That's Volkswagen. Now, as far as some other smaller names in that group, Magna International, are you familiar with them?
I've heard the name.
Magna? Yeah. They're the world's third largest automotive parts maker, and they're based in Canada.
MGA, is that correct?
MGA is the symbol. They've been working with LG Electronics since last year to make modular battery packs that are compatible with a wide variety of vehicle brands. And Magna is trading at only 12 times earnings or 0.75 times sales. And given the size of the opportunity, I think this is a bargain.
Chris Irons, who's been a guest here from Quoth the Raven, he's a big fan of Magna, of MGA as well. And talking about, you know, relatively speaking, it's not an expensive stock in the world that it, you know, you talk about NIO at 32 times sales. I think it trades with a P under 15 right now.
Yeah, I'm saying 12 times forward, my estimate of earnings. So 12 times forward earnings, which is
12 times. Okay.
Super, super cheap compared to obviously so many other companies in the world right now. And again, this is all prefaced on the idea that the auto industry is going to be re-rated, as they say in the biz, from low PEs to high PEs. And there's several, real technology companies that I think you're going to be involved. There's a chip maker called NXP Semiconductor. NXPI is the symbol. They make chips and connectivity systems that have become the lifeblood of EVs. They're the main chip that people think about when they talk about electronic vehicles. They're based in Holland, or the Netherlands, and their sales have been way up over the past year. And, you know, they're at the front line of the NXPI chips are at the center of the connectivity between cars, factories, and smart homes. And I think the NXPI will be one of the biggest chip makers in the world before too long. Another one that's really important in this space is Analog Devices, ADI. It's integrated circuits convert elements of the physical world into digital signals. And it's the first tier automotive and industrial customers are really using analog device chips at a high rate to turn things like temperature, sound, speed, and light into electronic signals that could be processed by the onboard computing systems. So ADI is a little bit more expensive. It's trading at 25 times forward earnings and 10 times sales, but that's pretty typical for a technology company.
So John, before we move on to other names, I just want to take a step back. So you're a publisher of investment research. Do you have positions in any of the names we're talking about here? Or these are just stocks that you recommended that people do more research on? Like, how should we think about your positions in these names?
Yeah, so I'm in a position as I am a research provider, and I do own some of these names, but not all of them. And I plan to buy more of them as the prices pull back.
Okay. And that's for your personal, you're not managing money is what I'm, I guess, more directly than what I'm asking.
No, I'm not managing money.
Okay.
I just provide ideas to people. I don't talk about the size of their portfolio or how much they should apportion to these ideas. I just want to bring these ideas to people and let them decide whether they are appropriate for them.
And another name I wanted to ask you about in this realm, you'd written about, which is QuantumScape, which you wrote about in a way, as sort of an indirect way to play on the prospects of an Apple car. Can you talk more about QuantumScape, symbol QS?
Yeah, so QuantumScape is a battery technology company backed by Bill Gates, as well as several other major investors. You know, they believe that they have a new battery system that will provide a solid-state lithium technology, and that'll be much better than what companies are using today. It's really on the come because they haven't actually produced this kind of battery yet, but investors are betting on it. So if you really want to take a flyer on the future of electric cars, that's one way to go. And as long as you realize the risk involved, QuantumScape, QS. And, you know, I don't really like sort of the big man theory of investing, like, i.e., if this guy's investing in it, you should too. Mm-hmm. But I will say that the last time I was on, I talked to you about a company called Schrodinger.
Sure.
Remember that? SGDR.
It's doubled.
Yeah, it's more than doubled since we talked, basically. And Bill Gates has been a big invisible investor in them. So, I mean, sometimes these big guys get it right. Yeah, you know, the multi-billionaire might know something.
It's pretty fascinating listening to you talk this way, talking about how companies like GM and Ford might start trading at tech-like multiples. We're so used to those guys trading at, you know, being pure cyclicals, trading at whatever, 6 to 8 times peak earnings. And you talked about kind of the rotation since September 1st out of some of the tech names into some of the more cyclical names. And I'm wondering if, like, the Amazons, Microsofts, Pelotons, Apples of the world, are they going to start to get auto company-like multiples? Why the auto companies get tech-like multiples?
That's a really hilarious question. The short answer is no. But, you know, look at Microsoft. You know, they're building the world's largest connected car platform in their Azure cloud. You know, product managers at Microsoft have gotten buy-ins on their program from Volkswagen, Renault, Mitsubishi, BMW, you know, Mercedes-Benz. And, you know, what's important to realize is that the cars of the future are not just going to communicate with the cloud for traffic, weather, and data analytics. They're also going to be communicating with other cars, helping to prevent, accidents and injury. And Azure, which is Microsoft's cloud computing platform, is going to be probably the biggest player in this space. So Microsoft will maintain its technology edge. I think people are going to be surprised by how successful Microsoft is over the next few years.
Yeah, we talked a lot about Microsoft your last appearance, and I don't want to go over it again, but you were pretty bullish on them, certainly relative to other mega cap tech stocks. And as I mentioned before, some of the other, you know, the quote-unquote FANG names have had some pretty big drawdowns. Microsoft, relatively speaking, has held up well compared mm-hmm. to Amazon, Netflix, Apple, et cetera, you know, in recent weeks. I assume that you still recommend Microsoft here?
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft has had a fantastic run, and right now it's about to pull back. So I think, you know, you might get like I think it's down 3.5% today. You might get like a 10% pullback in Microsoft, something like that. Not trying to predict the future, but that would be typical. And I think people will buy that. You know, the reason that Microsoft does better than Google and Apple for long stretches is that, frankly, people are skeptical of Microsoft.
Right.
And they overjudge the potential for Apple. But Microsoft is a much better and much more long-term oriented company than Apple, and I think it's going to do great. You know, one other company I like a lot in this space, and I'm sure we've talked about before, is NVIDIA.
Right.
NVIDIA is a big chip maker. They started as a PC chip maker, but they've now got partnerships with 350 car companies, and their Drive AGX program is really the key part of an onboard computer and software system that is powerful enough to process data simultaneously from multiple camera and radar sensors. You know, so if you think about self-driving autonomous vehicles and think about the computing power that's required to make all that stuff work, NVIDIA's AI-powered chips are really the way to go for these companies. And I think you're going to see NVIDIA, you know, really become even a bigger star than it already is. And it is a big star.
Right. And I wanted to ask about some of the names that, at least to me, were less familiar that you've recommended and written about recently, including Ambarella, Lumentum, and Viva Systems. Like, you know, what about these stocks do you like?
Well, you know, Ambarella, I would say, is the best of that bunch. They used to be known for their video processing that was found in GoPros. Remember GoPros?
Sure.
I don't know what happened to GoPro. I think it's still out there, but
the iPhone happened to GoPro, I think. Yeah, but anyway.
I think it's probably true. But you know, managers at Ambarella realized in 2015 that in order for them to grow, they needed to move beyond expensive toys. So they invested $250 million in designing cutting-edge computer vision chips with artificial intelligence. And these chips are really, really popular, especially with the Asian automotive companies. They're used in camera systems that are capable of identifying pedestrians and other automobiles that might be entering dangerous situations. And, you know, although their third quarter revenue fell in the last quarter, I think that you're going to see over time that Ambarella is going to be one of those companies that doubles or triples as the digital transformation of the auto industry takes hold.
Right, and I did want to ask you, you mentioned a bunch of names last time you were on as well. And we appreciate your talking about specific stocks. We have a lot of guests who don't or can't for whatever reason. Usually it's, you know, they're restricted. Last time you were here,
people don't want to be wrong. It's worse to be wrong than it is to be a little bit right.
That's true. Well, I was going to say, a lot of the stocks you have mentioned have done, you know, well since you were here again in late October, including The Trade Desk, Teladoc Health, Cadence Designs, MongoDB is up about 70% since you were here last. Yeah. And, you know, without getting into, you know, too much detail on any of them, like, are these names that you still like and would recommend?
Yeah, I love them. I really like them. MongoDB has been a tremendous online cloud-based database company that's really eating Oracle's lunch in the areas that they compete in. Cadence Design was one of only two major chip design manufacturing software makers. It's going to continue to well over the next 3 to 5 years. One company I mentioned last time, The Trade Desk, TTD,
sure.
They just announced an absolute blowout quarter. I think they're up 45% since the last time I talked to you. And I think it's another company I think that's going to do really, really well as connected TVs become more and more important. Peloton, I really love the company. I really love the product, but I think they may have peaked. There's a lot of competition coming online from companies like Nordic Track and Echelon. And as good as Peloton is, it probably doesn't deserve as big a multiple as it has, given its competition. One stock that I talked about last time that has not done that well is Danaher, DHR. It's only up 2% since we talked, and I still like Danaher. I think it's a long-term holding, and I'd be buying it down here.
And ServiceNow was another one you talked about?
Yeah, ServiceNow obviously has done pretty well. The story, you know, is pretty well known now, so it's not as exciting as it was back then. But, ServiceNow has really increased its share of digital transformation spend within companies, and I think it'll continue to do well. It's just not at the top of my list.
Not at the top of your list. Okay.
I'll tell you one stock that is at the top of my list that's
yes.
a little bit different is TransDigm. Are you familiar with TransDigm? TDG. It's a maker of aircraft parts, and it's really important for the aerospace and defense industry. TransDigm is just one of those tremendous companies that has has basically written the playbook for the Pentagon and for aerospace companies such that it's the sole supplier of many of the most important parts for these for jet aircraft. And, you know, when TDG pulls back as it has now over the past year, it's always been a good opportunity to buy, and I still like it here. As a play on the digital transformation of transportation, and in this case, I mean airplanes.
Right, interesting, because obviously the quote unquote story today is about Boeing and, you know, new problems with different jets than they've had before with the, you know, the MAX jet. And, you know, Transdim's down a little bit, but maybe on that news or not, or is it totally separate from the Boeing story?
Well, I mean, Boeing is kind of interesting because it's essentially got a monopoly on aircraft manufacturing in this country. Can you name another big aircraft maker? Right.
Maybe no, General Airbus, Dynamics. You know, and they're not Airbus. They're European, right? Yeah.
And General Dynamics, which makes the, you know, business jets. So, I mean, you can't really give up on Boeing. They've had their struggles. They make very complicated and difficult machines, and they've had some troubles with them. But I do think that over time, you'll see Boeing come back into investors' favor. But even if you don't want to wait that long, there are, as I say, parts makers in the aerospace industry that are fantastic, and TransDigm is one of those. TDG.
Right. And as we're talking, sorry, I just want to mention, you know, Boeing has now gone positive for the day. So, you know, all those worries seem to have been priced in, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, you think of things as being really horrible, but then you discover that the bad news is already in stock. So what are you going to do? Right. It's a bad time to be a short seller. I mean, I'm sure when the short seller saw that news over the weekend, they thought they'd come into work and, you know, Boeing would be down 3 or 4%. And instead, look at it, it's up. So
I just wanted to ask you about another industry, as long as we're on flying. A lot of people are talking about the massive multi-trillion dollar opportunity in space exploration. There's not a lot of kind of peer play publicly traded companies in there. There's Virgin Galactic, which everyone kind of has some hopes and dreams in. Do you have an opinion about that industry and any players that interest you?
Yeah, you know, I've looked at space for a long time because I think it should offer a great opportunity. But the problem is there just aren't very many plays in the space. And they all are really tied to the aerospace cycle and to the war cycle. So you might like, you know, Lockheed Martin for all of the great work it's doing in space, but it's really being dragged down by the lack of wars. And I hate to say it this way, but...
Not enough war. It's, you know, yeah. It's a good enough, thing.
It's just not enough war to keep all the aerospace manufacturers busy. And because, you know, they really depend on, what do they call them? Disposables, like missiles.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. All right. So,
but although there is one company in the space I like a lot, and I've been recommending for a couple of years, it's called Maxar Technologies, M-A-X-R. Mm-hmm. They make geospatial photography possible, and it's really cheap company. Last year it was trading around $10. Now it's around $47. But I think, you know, this is a company that'll be probably $80 or $90 company by the end of 2023. Yeah, I think they'll double up by the end of 2023. So that's Maxar, M-A-X-R. But what I thought you were going to ask me about was the travel industry.
Sure, happy to.
Well, you're bullish on sort of the return to normal travel business, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think this is like the biggest question that investors have right now. It's like, is there going to be a return to normal and when? I mean, there's a lot of people who say that, you know, that it's a false belief that when vaccination reaches, you know, 30 or 40%, everyone's going to be able to go, you know, travel again and enjoy themselves and blah, blah, blah. And there's a lot of other people who say, no, that's not true. You know, the reopening scenario is overblown. I don't think it's overblown. I think that when vaccines reach a critical mass and people just get tired of being at home, they're going to travel again. And I think if you look at some of the travel industry players, investors are betting in that direction, even though it seems too early. I'm talking about companies like JetBlue, Carnival, the cruise maker, cruise line company, Marriott, the hotel chain, MGM, the casino chain, and of course, Wynn, which everybody hates, but it's actually doing quite well, and I think it'll continue to do well.
Interesting. Yeah, and a lot of the casino stocks are at highs here. Yeah.
I'm getting beyond my area of expertise. I'm just giving you my opinion on what that reopening trade could look like. And right now, you know, everyone hates airlines and everyone hates hotels, but that's a good spot for investors.
All right. And before we really go, John, I know you're not, you know, deep into the crypto weeds as our next guest, Greg King, but you do have what I would call sort of a backdoor crypto recommendation, and it's a SPAC, which, you know, we've had Chris DeMuth on here a couple of times. You know, SPACs sort of like encompasses everything about this market today. So tell me about VPC Impact.
Well, I mean, there's nothing that special about SPACs other than that it's a cheaper way to go public.
Exactly.
Without paying a big tax to the
investment banks. Yeah, no, I'm all for them, to be honest, for that reason alone.
I mean, you know, when companies come at first, like a year ago, and companies were coming forward by SPACs, it was people were holding their nose. But now a lot of these SPACs are backed by big companies. They're spin-outs of smaller, of bigger companies, backed by major players like Elliott and Michael Klein. So, yeah, I'm not that worried about the whole SPAC problem. But the one that you were mentioning is called VPC Impact. And I think the symbol is VIH.
That's correct. And yeah.
This is a company that is being spun out of International ICE, which is the owner of the New York Stock Exchange. And they're creating an exchange for Bitcoin. This has been tried before, but obviously coming out of the NYSE, it has a lot more heft. And not only are you going to be able to trade Bitcoin on its platform, but all the other sort of weird semi-currencies that you have in your pocket, such as Starbucks points, you know, airline miles, Target points, things like that. Things that really have value but are not exchangeable normally. All these are going to be lumped together with cryptocurrencies to have on an exchange. And I think that holds a lot of promise. It's super, super speculative, but I'd look at that one if you're interested in a sideways play on crypto. And that symbol is VIH.
Interesting.
All right, a speculative play and a bunch of other recommendations as always. John, we love having you on. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you again.
Our guest has been John Markman, president and founder of Markman Capital. You can find all his work and access to the Strategic Advantage newsletter at markmancapital.net.
May I say that if people want a special 2-week trial, they can email me directly at john@mcillc.net. john@mcillc.net. Just email me and I'll send you a special link where you can get a 2-week trial.
Awesome. A special birthday bonus for our listeners from the birthday man himself, John Markman. thanks again, John. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Greg King, CEO and founder of Osprey Funds, here to talk about all things crypto and the launch of the Osprey Bitcoin Trust. You're listening to Alpha Trader. Welcome back to Alpha Trader. We're joined now by Greg King. He's the CEO and founder of Osprey Funds, which is a subsidiary of Rec Shares. Previously, he co-founded Velocity Shares and has launched over 100 ETPs, including the first to track the VIX and FANG stocks. Greg, welcome to Alpha Trader.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Thanks for being here. And you guys have recently launched an Osprey Bitcoin Trust, which we want to talk about in a minute. But first, I want to get your thoughts on what's happening with Bitcoin itself. We're talking here Monday mid-morning, and it's been a wild 48 hours. Bitcoin has gone over 58,000, then crashed below 50,000, now bouncing back to 53,000. You know, in the immediate term, is there anything that you've seen that could account for this kind of wild swing just in the last 24 hours?
You know, I don't know if there's any one thing I can point to. I know that we've all been inundated with headlines around the $50,000 level being, you know, psychologically important. And I think you saw it push through that pretty hard and decisively. And in my mind, there's just going to be profit taking at that point. You really have, I think the volatility is reflective of the two camps, the people that are thinking the rally might be overdone, and then the other people more convinced that this is sustainable. I think we're on the other side of the latter side of that equation. We feel like this is just another move through another nice round number on a significant bull rally here. So, any specific catalyst.
Right. And you've been a long time investor in Bitcoin. How do you account for the explosion we've seen just really since the fourth quarter? I mean, it was trading, not much above 10,000 in September, October, and then obviously got a huge move above 40,000. Again, another overnight bear market, and then, recovering back to close to 60,000 before this last downturn, again, in the last 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. So, the way we look at it is just in a historical context. And we're long-term bulls, right? We think that Bitcoin is here to stay. We think it's a digital substitute for gold and maybe even bring some features to the equation that gold doesn't possess and could potentially outpace gold over time in terms of market cap. So that's kind of our long-term view. As far as what happened since the fourth quarter, I think it's actually pretty straightforward. If you look at Bitcoin historically, whenever you had an all-time high that persisted for at least a couple hundred days, so a significant all-time high that's put in and there's a significant consolidation on the other side of that, then once that all-time high is pierced, and you have four instances of this, you have on average a 900% run up in the following rally. I think the low was around 390% and the high was around 1600% and change. But on average, it was say 900%. So
thank you for repeating that, because I was going to double check. You did say 900%.
900. Yeah. if you think about, we all remember 2017 and everything that happened with Bitcoin there. I mean, the previous high there was, I think it was 1300, 1400, right? And so, it was down. I remember in a couple hundred dollars the coin and consolidating for call it a year and a half. It started approaching back up to 1,000, and people say, well, is it going to break its all-time high? Well, ultimately it did. But then it went on to touch 20,000, right? From piercing through the 1300, 1400 level. That's not 900%. That's more, but it kind of shows you what's possible. So here we just pierced 20,000, 3 months ago. And now we're at 50, in our view, there's still ways to go in this bull rally.
And I'm glad you mentioned kind of the 2017 bull run. What really kind of perked my interest in Bitcoin was not necessarily the price level. People forget how few amount of days Bitcoin actually spent above, 12 or 13,000 in 2017. I mean, it was a short kind of blow off top there. And what really got my interest going last year, not that I'm an investor in Bitcoin, my interest more as a reporter, was the amount of time that it spent in the high teens. I'm like, well, there's some serious kind of interest here, as opposed to 2017, which was kind of like this ICO bubble where people needed to buy Bitcoin to get involved in these ICOs. Did you see that as well?
Yeah, back then I did. I think, there were other components too. That was the first time people thought a Bitcoin ETF was right around the corner. You could probably make the argument that that's a component of today's rally as well, is just some speculation on potentially a Bitcoin ETF. Although, jury's still out on how close that is. But then you also had, back in 2017, you had the futures contracts that were coming online and everyone was getting excited about those. As a matter of fact, they represented the top. I think that the top day was like the day the first futures contract launched. People may have thought that those launches would have been a bullish thing, but turned out they were bearish at that point anyway.
You mentioned the Bitcoin ETF. There was one that launched in Canada last week, and it launched to an incredible demand for that country. On several hundred million dollars poured into it right away. What do you see in the future for an ETF possibly in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, demand-wise, obviously, pretty much an order of magnitude is kind of the Canadian ETF market versus the U.S. is about a tenth the size. But in terms of when and how, people are watching, you know, the changeover in the administration at the SEC, right? You've got Gary Gensler coming in, probably won't be firmly implanted for a few months still. He's technologically, I think, more capable than his predecessor, certainly knows a lot more about crypto, taught a class at MIT about it.
That's right.
And so I think that the general feeling out there is that's more constructive and more likely to lead to the approval of an ETF. But if there's one thing I've learned dealing with the SEC, it's that they, especially with this topic, they're very thorough. They know the power of the U.S. markets. They know the size of the U.S. markets and investor demand. So they just want to be very cautious. And I don't think that they're very susceptible to sort of peer pressure, right? If you call it that. People ask about that all the time. It's like, well, hey, you know, the Germans have launched an ETF on Bitcoin or the Canadians or what have you. I really don't think that the SEC cares.
I will. So this is a good segue. You're talking about launching products. Again, as I mentioned at the top, you guys recently launched the Osprey Bitcoin Trust. The symbol is OBTC. And, you know, for my own education, how is that different than a Bitcoin ETF? Like what would be the distinction between the two?
Yeah. So in the U.S., several years back, a company called Grayscale Investments created a Bitcoin trust and then listed it under ticker symbol on the OTC markets. And that has quietly grown into an over $30 billion, you know, ticker-based, so in other words, publicly traded access vehicle for Bitcoin in the United States. That structure, actually, the legal bones of the fund are the exact same as an ETF. The only difference is that the exemptions that make an ETF work, namely the ability to offer it publicly, number one, and then the ability to offer redemptions, number two, are not available to them or to us or to anyone at this point, because if the SEC approved us to, you know, to do those two things, then voila, they would, you know, we would have ETFs. So these structures can potentially be converted to ETFs once the, you know, the light flashes green instead of red. But so far it's still, you know, maybe it's turning a slight yellow tint, but you know, we're not holding our breath necessarily. However, it's something we do watch closely because, as you mentioned at the beginning, I'm sort of an ETF guy by background. So that is the direction ultimately that we would like to head.
All right. So the trust itself, what problem does it solve for me as a potential investor? And you know, why do we need another one? I mean, you mentioned Grayscale. I think probably most of our listeners are familiar with it. It's been around for several years. It's gotten big. Why does Osprey need to come into this space?
So we thought that investors want choice. Number one, they want to save on fees if they can. So we came in at a very kind of rock bottom price point, 49 basis point management fee versus 200.
Wow.
And you know, that's more along the lines of what investors expect for a passive beta access product. Secondly, with Bitcoin, you care about where the coins are stored. That's a very big deal. You know, if you've got a fund holding stock, you know, 999 out of 1,000 investors will have no idea who custodies those shares, right? And it doesn't really matter because nobody's going to hack in and steal your Apple shares and then all of a sudden they're gone and nobody can find them. But that kind of thing does happen with Bitcoin. So you need to care about who's storing the Bitcoin, how they're doing it. And so simply put, you know, we're offering a lower price diversified choice because our custodian for this fund is Fidelity. And people know who Fidelity is. You know, Fidelity's been around for 75 or 80 years. Obviously, large, well-known, trusted institution in the U.S. asset management landscape. So, you know, in most markets that big, you'd have way more than two choices. We're just the second choice to come along. And we think it's appreciated by the clients we're speaking to.
Right. And the fact that Fidelity is the custodian, forgive me if this is the dumb question, does that mean that any customer of Fidelity can purchase the Osprey Bitcoin Trust? Because I know Grayscale, it's limited and, you know, depending on which brokerage you have, whether you can purchase it or not.
Right. So this goes back to the fact that it's not able to be publicly offered like an ETF. And so these trusts are essentially forced to trade on the OTC market. So we can't list them on the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange. And therefore, every broker dealer has a different policy of how they treat those types of instruments. And not only that, you know, the clients have to sign off. So, for example, if, you know, if you've got 5 years left for retirement and you, you know, you fill out the questionnaire at your broker dealer and say, I'm a conservative investor, et cetera, et cetera, you're probably not going to be allowed to buy something like this. Or if you're at one of the large platforms that basically doesn't allow OTC stocks, you can't buy this either. So each platform is different. We've got a very good relationship with Fidelity, and they are onboarding our fund as we speak, actually. So I know that it can be held at Fidelity, and they're working to be able to open it up so investors can also purchase.
Right. Well, just as an aside, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people who would like to invest in Bitcoin and are being basically prohibited, or there's obstacles in front of them. So there's potentially a lot of buying demand out there that hasn't been able to access Bitcoin because of the restrictions you just mentioned. But on the flip side, why should I buy a trust, whether it's Osprey's or Grayscale's or some other competitor that comes along, versus buying Bitcoin directly at Coinbase, or now you can do through PayPal or things like that?
Yeah, no, that's the other half to the question you answered is like, why does anybody need this? So the reality is, you know, we have constraints in life, right? And, you know, maybe you or me can be a good example of this. I have a Coinbase account, you know, and I buy some crypto there. I also bought some on PayPal just for fun, right? But the bulk of my assets is, you know, my sort of nest egg is in a brokerage account, in an IRA. And I'm not going to pull assets out of there to wire over to, you know, an online exchange, et cetera. I personally don't have a financial advisor. I handle it myself. But a lot of people do have financial advisors. And those financial advisors have really no good options, until us, of course, for accessing Bitcoin. Think about it. If you're an advisor and your client comes to you and says, I want access to Bitcoin. And let's say, you know, they don't have access to a hedge fund, because if you're at the accredited investor level, you certainly have access to a number of hedge funds and things like that in the crypto space. But if you're sort of a mainstream investor, and whether you're self-directed or advised by an advisor, you kind of want to keep your money in your brokerage account. It's being supervised by you or them, or in an IRA. You've really had one choice for the last 5 years. That's a Grayscale fund. Now you got two. Congratulations. You know, it's still very limited, but you're absolutely right. There's definitely demand out there. There's definitely people who want access, who haven't found good ways to get it. And so we're trying to proof upon what's possible right now. Of course, a full-fledged ETF would be a better option, I think, for investors and for the market as a whole. But right now, this is what's possible in the U.S. So we just want to deliver what we think is a better option to investors.
And I was listening to a podcast over the weekend with Michael Saylor from MicroStrategy, who has gone all in on Bitcoin, just raised another $1 billion last week to buy more Bitcoin. He said there was a feature in the Grayscale Trust that says that trust can never sell its Bitcoin. Whatever, Grayscale is like a very large percent of the market now. He's like, those coins will never be sold. I'm asking you, is that a fact? And do you have something similar in the paperwork for your fund?
So that's an interesting point. I'd say that, and I'm not, you know, an expert on Grayscale's trust and their rules and everything. I'll just speak generically, theirs and ours. These trusts are set up as grantor trusts, and they're not actively managed. So yes, in a sense, that's correct. If the trust maintains its current kind of profile, no Bitcoin will be sold. I mean, the Bitcoin to pay the management fee gets sold and whatever expenses, but that's, you know, a small portion. However, you know, somebody should ask him, well, what happens if the fund applies to convert to an ETF and therefore redemptions are allowed? Well, then, of course, those funds could be sold. Mm-hmm. So in its current construct, yes. However, that can change, you know. It's sort of like the U.S. Constitution, right? It's pretty grounded. But, you know, it can also change.
You do have those amendments,
critical mass, and people want to add something to it, then it happens. It hasn't happened for a while, but it can happen.
All right. And Greg, before we let you go, who would you say the Osprey Bitcoin Trust is for in terms of an investor? Is it a buy and hold type vehicle, or is it a trading vehicle, a hedge? How would you describe it?
We view it as a buy and hold type vehicle. And, you know, I think, so another thing I should probably clarify, I'm sure some of your listeners know this, but it's worth repeating. Because these trusts are not publicly offered, they're offered direct to accredited investors only who need to hold them for a 1-year holding period. We are going to be applying to reduce that holding period to 6 months, but that takes a little time. Those are the investors that can get access at the NAV. On the secondary market, these trade typically at a premium. So investors buying in the secondary market should definitely be careful about that and make sure that they're kind of doing their homework before they press, you know, the buy order button. They should use limit orders and that kind of thing. Because the secondary, I mean, you saw what happened with Bitcoin, like you were saying, just in the last 24, 48 hours. There's that underlying these trusts, but also whatever premium may exist can add to that effect. So investors need to be careful about that. But if you pick a good entry point, we view it as a buy and hold investment. That's why we priced it at a low management fee. And that's why we've made it available for brokerage accounts and IRAs. IRAs is the way that I prefer to do this because of the potential gains.
Right. And should investors expect a roughly one-to-one correlation between the performance of the trust and Bitcoin itself?
At an NAV level, absolutely. Yeah. So the NAV of the fund, the fund is 100% invested in Bitcoin. We use the Coinmetrics Bitcoin Index. We think Coinmetrics is a great newish crypto company, and they do a robust job of kind of tracking the space. The NAV, but it's sort of similar to like a closed-end fund, right? Sometimes trades at a premium. We haven't really seen discounts in this space at this point because I think demand exceeds supply. But the NAV will track the secondary market price. You got to watch a little more carefully.
All right. Well, that's always good advice. Do your homework, of course, do your research. But it's the Osprey Bitcoin Trust, symbol OBTC. Our guest has been Greg King. He's the CEO and founder of Osprey Funds. Greg, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg.